This is Suno India production. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android and iPhone app. Download it now.
Bangalore is now increasingly witnessing rapid urbanization in varied forms that has taken a toll on the city's environment. And the major brunt of this situation is being borne by people who are living in slums across Bangalore. The city has more than 2,000 slums, with only 25% of these slums having access to some basic services. Also, due to the lack of resources, the priorities of these residents in these settlements do not include climate change adaptation and mitigation strategies. This is also because their immediate needs are not addressed. Then how do we make these residents an active participant in the agenda of climate change? Hi, I'm Sneha Richharia, your host for this episode of Climate Emergency Podcast. And to talk about this, we have Bijal Brahmbhatt with us today. She's the Executive Director of Mahila Housing Trust, which is a grassroots organization that works to strengthen women in the urban informal sector in Bangalore. My first question to you would be that we know that, you know, the climate crisis is big in all metropolitan cities. But why do we need to worry particularly about Bangalore when it comes to climate vulnerability?
Namaste, everyone. So as you already said, Sneha, you know, India actually is urbanizing very fast. So some time back, we had an urban population of 461 million. But by 2050, that will rise to 800 million. Now, Bangalore district actually tops the list in terms of urbanization. The urbanization level in the district is 90 to 94%. And as you know, with that kind of urbanization, you know, there is a lot of in-migration in the city. In-migration, you know, both of job seekers who are educated, who are of the formal class because of the booming IT industry, but at the same time also of people in the informal sector. Because of the fact that the urbanization is increasing, it's all about infrastructure development. It's all about housing development. And as one knows, you know, built environment actually contributes to 40% of the greenhouse gas emissions, which lead to climate change. And in our experience, we have seen that negative impacts of climate change actually are enhanced due to the greenhouse gas emission generated by the built environment, but also how the built environment is planned and it's executed. It not only, you know, enhances the intensity and the frequency of climate events, but it also gives rise to other slow onset but potential disasters, which are slow, but, you know, they are very, very potent in terms of impacting the lives of the communities living in Bangalore. For example, if you look at rising heat stress, you know, it is abstract. It is not seen. It is only felt. But it gives rise to a lot of losses, a lot of discomfort in the lives of the communities that are living in Bangalore. And that's why I think Bangalore is in some way very unique as compared to other cities in India. Air pollution in Bangalore has increased heavily. And that's largely because of the industries that are developing. Also because, you know, you have so much increase in traffic. The city has changed, as you say, you know, the city has 1.5 crore vehicles in Bangalore. And, you know, so it's just too much traffic, too much pollution with lack of a central transport system. On the other hand, the intriguing factor also is that, you know, while Bangalore is increasingly getting flooded, it's also all the time facing water scarcity. So water is supplied on alternate days in Bangalore, but it is still all the time getting flooded. So this is something which is really very intriguing and a feature, unique feature of Bangalore too.
And how do we understand this contrast?
So the issue is that as, you know, there are several things happening at the same time. Climate change would essentially mean that you have very short spells of intense rain and otherwise long periods of droughts. What has happened in Bangalore is that when you have these short spells of intense rains, the kind of infrastructure which has been constructed is actually barricading the natural drainage of the city. And therefore, you see flash floods all the time. On the other side, it has been a water scarce region to the extent that, well, you know, it's always raining, but being a plateau, the water flows away and it gets concentrated in certain part of the plateau. The upper part of the plateau will not have, you know, the water, but the water will run off and get collected into the lower part of the plateau. Thirdly, I think Bangalore was also a city of lakes. It used to have several lakes and which used to cater to the city's water requirement. Unfortunately, a lot of them are now getting filled up. And therefore, this ambiguity or so to say a contrast where you see flooding, but at the same time, you see water scarcity. You may have seen in the newspapers on and off that there is a big feud between, generally between Karnataka and Tamil Nadu, you know, on the waters of the river Kaveri. And, you know, Bangalore, the population of Bangalore, the water supply demand for Bangalore also largely caters to that.
We know that, you know, poverty increases the vulnerability to impacts of climate change. And this is one of the areas that I've been following a lot of work that MHT does, one of the focus areas. So can you begin by explaining, because we're talking about Bangalore as a city, can you begin by explaining the demography of the city that will also help us understand who actually in the city is the most vulnerable?
So approximately 60 lakh people, 40% of the population of Bangalore. So Bangalore's population is approximately 1.5 crore and about 60 lakh people are sort of living in 2,000 slum settlements all across Bangalore. And because the poor do not have the wherewithal to buy housing, what would they do is that they would come into the city and they would park their belongings or their shelter and build slowly in places wherever they have contacts. And usually these places are places that no formal citizen with access to any money will occupy. So it will be places near drainage nalas, open nalas, which will get flooded. It will be places which are very low-lying and usually get flooded. Right now, the lakes of Bangalore have been fenced by the municipal corporation, but it will also be near lakes because lakes are natural drainage systems and so they are topographically low-lying. And these are areas where, you know, the water needs are met easily. And therefore, the poor would, you know, would come and stay. And then, of course, they stay near all the big booming construction sites. So you will find many, many labor sites, construction sites in Bangalore where they stay nearby. And because of that, you know, one, they are poor. Secondly, they are living in vulnerable areas, areas which are more vulnerable to climate change, like getting flooded easily. Secondly, near industries or construction sites, which generate a lot of air pollution, right? Because those are their places of work. So construction and industries are the main contributors of air pollution. Thirdly, also in the kind of housing that they live, because they don't have legal titles, they would construct semi-permanent houses, which would essentially be with, you know, AC sheet roofing or tin sheet roofing. And this would ensure that the temperature indoor would increase much more as compared to outdoors. So indoors temperature would be 5 to 6 degrees higher than what it is outside. And, you know, therefore that, I mean, in addition to poverty, their vulnerability also increases because of the impact of climate change.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing, one of the initiatives that I know of, the well-known white roofing, right? As you were also talking about it, but you know, one thing that I want to understand is what are the other programs, you know, that are being run in the city other than white roofing, because that runs in the, we know, during the heat wave. But what is it that the organization is doing, and you know, how do you plan to include the most affected lot?
What we do actually as Mahila Housing Trust is that we go out to the most vulnerable communities, poor settlements, as I said, living near nalas or living on private lands, which are often subjected to threat of eviction. And we start organizing them around their issues. And as you rightly said, you know, they always talk of their short-term needs, you know, which is like, where do I get money for my child's education? How do I increase my livelihood? And also on top of the list is how do I access water, or I don't have access to toilet, you know, so the quality of life is also very important. Now for them, we work on urban habitats for the poor. So we do have to start with these immediate needs, like, you know, supporting them to get access to water or toilets or, you know, so, and the best way to do that is that they get linked to legal services. And by that, I mean linked to government services. So you organize them, you develop their community action groups, and then you train them to interact with suppliers like the Bruhad Bangalore Mahanagarpalike or the, you know, the BESCOM, which is the electricity provider. And how do you really approach them and negotiate with them to get these services? Now, having said that, you know, at the same time, we layer the science of climate change and try and work with them to sort of explain to them, you know, what is climate change, how it is going to happen. Now, this dual strategy, because, you know, if you talk to them about climate change, for them, it's not the topmost need. So unless and until you combine climate change initiatives with their topmost need, they may not be really interested. So that's why this combination of strategy. So, you know, our experience is that when we start working with the poor, they don't know what climate change is. They merely think it's God's act. So they'll say, yeah, it's hotter than earlier. Or, you know, rain is very erratic, you know, sometimes appearing in non-rainy season, etc. But they wouldn't be able to understand that it's a man-made phenomena. So how do you really explain it to them? And then how do you really, you know, sort of tell them or work with them to make them understand that, you know, how it's going to impact their livelihoods, their lives, their children, and therefore you, it's a scientific phenomena, right? So you have to really unpack that scientific phenomena in a very, very layman's language, you know, by creative gamification or videos and other, you know, tools, so that they understand it. And also along with the other needs that they prioritize, they start taking action on that.
Yeah. And as you rightly said, you've been, from what I understand, you know, organizing people who live in the informal settlements, organizing people who are more vulnerable. This is of course one of the ways in which you know, we can ensure that the net zero transition is just. But what is it that is being done on the part of the government, and what are, because I'm sure you've been collaborating with a lot of you know, other government agencies. So what is it that they are doing, and how is the response from there?
So I think the government is doing a lot, but at the same time, I would also like to mention another initiative that we had started, in fact, which is going on in the city of Bangalore, is that we have built a coalition called Ellara Bangaloru around the issues of urban development, vulnerability, and climate change. And more than 30 organizations have participated in that. They are actively meeting. They are discussing issues. We are also trying to co-create solutions with them. And each of these organization actually is, a name in their own area. So it's not that Mahila Housing Trust has come into Bangalore and started talking about climate change. Each of them have been doing it in their own separate ways.
I also want to talk about the challenges, because you said that, you know, of course, coming together of so many people is tough, but even when you go to the grassroots, you go to the communities, the women who primarily play a part, as I've seen a lot of work that MHT does includes women from the urban settlements. But how complex has been the process? How, if you could share with us some of the challenges that you've been facing, some stories that you have.
Yeah, I think the first challenge we have been experiencing actually is making the poor understand the phenomena of climate change and then continue to work on it, because they think it's really far from their lives and they have other priorities, which is true. So actually we adopted this dual strategy of working on their utmost priorities and then building on climate change onto such priorities. The second thing is that, as I said, you have to bring in urban development, the most vulnerable, and climate action together. So, for example, the city of Bangalore now has a climate action plan, but it is currently not speaking to the kind of urban development, or, for example, climate action is not figuring into the city's current, master plan. Not that, it has a master plan. I think it's overdue since long, but it's not getting finalized. So I think unless and until this integration happens, we are all working in silos and there is a lot to be desired. The issue with urban governments in India is that, they have a lot on their hands. So they have not yet emerged from their day-to-day, needs of the citizens that they have to address, like waste management or, say, housing or, say, a sewage getting, overflow. This huge amount of population that you cater to is something that every city in India, not only Bangalore, today is grappling with. And these are some of the challenges that we'll have to address together.
One final question that I wanted to understand is, when it comes to solutions like, let's say, white roofing or others that you do, what are the conversations over sustainability of these solutions?
When people talk of sustainability, they only think of technologies. My humble submission is that it's also an approach. So when igniters or catalysts like Socrates or Hasrudala or, probably Restless Development and Mahila Housing Trust move away, how is it that the citizens continue this? So if the citizens take it up on their own, and especially the poor, they take it up on their own, and if they continue it, then the approach is also sustainable. So I think we need to sort of, broaden our sort of horizons of the definition that we have of sustainability. That's one. Secondly, sustainability would mean that whatever is good for me is good for me, and then it continues till the next generation. But that necessarily cannot be. I mean, it's always best to have a very, very costly roofing, but it means that if you can never have it, then what's the use? So I think India, in this sustainability conversations are also the centered around the most theoretical, the most idealist lobby, which wants to give everything. And then there are organizations like Mahila Housing Trust, which also are very pragmatic. And we know that we are a poor country and we have to do it within the limited resources of the government and of the people. And therefore, if even for a certain period of time, you can improve the lives of people, and then again, probably ask them, or they adopt behavioral practices which can, be reignited by little investments into their day-to-day life, which they recurringly keep doing, I think that's also an approach, but it's not understood very well.
Yeah, I think with this, we come to the end of this conversation. Thank you very much for speaking to us. Bijal ji, thank you very much. It was fascinating speaking to you.
Thank you, Sneha. My pleasure.
Thank you.